Brun called the Mahoney residence, and for a wonder, George answered.
George, it's Brun.
Oh, if you want my father, he's still not...
No, I know that. I was after you.
Brun, I'm sorry I didn't come to see you after your father. I mean, I've been so busy with Dad in the hospital.
I know, George. I'm not upset. I just need to talk to you.
I should tell you, I've been going out with your cousin.
George, of all people, sounded embarrassed. Brun couldn't see what this had to do with his father's injuries, her father's assassination, or the political situation. Still, she knew what to do with that opening.
Seriously?
Looks that way. We're both in law school.
Brun had a sudden cold worry that this was the leak through which Harless had gained information.
Which cousin?
Not Harless's, Jessamine's.
Her mother's sister's child. The one she had dismissed so blithely back on Cerealis, the first year the girl came for hunting.
Sydney?
No, that's her older sister. This is Veronica. What did you want, Brun?
Information, of course. Where is everyone in our crowd? And what's going on? Since I got back, well, things have happened too fast, and you're the only one here I can ask without getting a lecture.
Ronnie and Rafa are off pioneering. You knew that, didn't you?
Yes, though I still think they're crazy. Do you know where?
Some dismal colony world. I can look it up if you want. I send mail via the development office. Rather, I did at first, but they don't answer. What with law school...
Oh, never mind, George. I do hope your father's better soon.
He's not like himself at all, Brun. I remember when you were getting Lady Cecilia out. I never realized what it's like when someone you know doesn't even seem to recognize you. And he can't talk. He just makes these noises.
She didn't want to think about that. She couldn't and stay reasonable.
Oh, George, I'm so sorry. If it's all right, I'll call again. We should stay in touch.
All right.
Brun felt guilty for a moment, but then turned her mind to the more pressing problem of finding out what was going on in politics. She still didn't expect anything much to happen in the Grand Council meeting, but it was always better to be prepared. She checked the directory her mother had left with her, frowning as one name after another came up absent. Apparently, a lot of people thought nothing much was going to happen and had not bothered to stay on Castle Rock and find out. Brun slipped her card into the slot, unlocking her chair's displays and communications, and settled into her chair. Aside from the formal presentation when she became old enough to have a seat, she had not been to any meetings, and none of her dreams in the years since had involved taking part in a routine council meeting. At the far end of their family table, her uncle Harless glowered at her, then leaned over to speak to her cousin Kel.
Well, I already knew I couldn't expect help from him.
She smiled, trying for the serenity that had always been her mother's trademark. The ministers straggled in, no longer in the formal robes she remembered. She wondered when they'd quit wearing them, and whether her father had put an end to it. Hobart Consoline stood at the speaker's podium. Brun blinked, surprised. The Consoline family had lost ground in the wake of the Patchcock scandal because the Morallines were in their sept. Even though no one could prove that the Consolines had known about it, other families had taken advantage of the opportunity to take market share from the largest and wealthiest of the septs.
When did they regain their influence? And what does it mean?
Brun skimmed the minutes of the emergency meeting after her father's death. As Brun adjusted the viewer to bring each face into focus, she noticed something odd. To the speaker's right, the minister's faces expressed suppressed glee, mingled with impatience and even anger. To his left, the faces seemed lifeless, sodden with despair.
What is going on?
She looked around for anyone she knew who might give her a clue, but she had been away too long. The seating arrangements had rotated again. No one was where she expected. She called up the seating chart.
No one. Wait. Sarah's older sister Lynette has a chair one row over and four up.
She entered the call code and her own name. The screen lit and letters appeared. Good to have you back, Brun. Thanks, she entered, then glanced at Lynette, who smiled and nodded. Any idea what's going on today? Yes, but I won't put it on screen. We'll talk at the break. That was clear as mud. Brunn glanced over. Linnet nodded again, this time without smiling. She would have to figure it out for herself. She referred again to the desk's data bank. The unhappy ministers first. Her father's appointees, she realized by the dates. The longest in office. Foreign Affairs. Cabby de Lonker. Minor family, but a good solid man she knew her father respected. Defense, Irian Solinari. Another minor family. Her father had long promoted the view that minor families should take their turn in major roles. The clerk minister, Emily Saint-Foin, who supervised the clerical staff. The gleeful ones were all new. Her father had appointed one at the council meeting just before his death, Ellery Sa-Consel, Legislative Affairs. A consuline, but one Kevel had recommended. She'd found that in her father's papers. The others had been appointed at the emergency session held immediately after her father's death. A new Minister of Internal Security, to replace Pauli de Marktos, who had obviously just failed in his duty, and whose offer to resign had been accepted so swiftly. Bristar Anston Consuline. A new legal advisor, replacing Kevel Mahoney. Sarah Vassell, born a consuline, Brunn noted with a quick flick of the data in the bio section. Judicial Affairs, instead of Clary Whitlow, who had held the post since before Chemtree's abdication. Norum Radson, whom even Brunn had heard of as a troublemaker in the legal profession. Colonial Affairs, Davor Vremont.
So, it looks like a consuline coup. In that case, why is my uncle looking so complacent? Did he not see it, or did he know already?
The excitement started before the meeting. Chemtree Altman, the former king, came forward to stand in front of the table. He had evidently rejuved again since she'd seen him last. He looked smooth and healthy, with only a decorative streak of white in his hair, though there was still the faint suggestion of a drooping eagle to his posture.
I yield the floor to our beloved former king.
Thank you. I just want to ask all of you to put the realm, the Familius, first, as you think about the issues before us. There's been a lot of dissension, a lot of anger, a lot of conflict among us.
There has?
Brunn had heard nothing of it from her father in their brief time together, but perhaps he had concealed it from her.
We need to think about the good of the whole Familius Regnant. In the face of all the threats to our stability, we must not fall prey to internal bickering. The welfare of all is more important than any petty personal grievances.
No. Don't you start, Victor!
Brunn scrabbled at the databank controls, trying to figure out who these people were, even as Chemtree bowed and made his way back up the aisle to a sprinkling of applause, clearly stronger in some areas than others. Victor. That had to be Victor Barraclough, a distant relative, the eldest of the elder branch of the Sept, though not the elected head of the family. And the other man? She looked again at the seating chart. Alfred Sebastian Moraline Conton. Political instincts she had not known she possessed told her the whole thing was a setup. Hobart Consuline had pulled a coup, and Chemtree appealed for unity because he knew there was none. And her Uncle Harless was not surprised or dismayed, as he should have been when a rival family grabbed so much power, which meant that he had known ahead of time. He had been bought with what coin she thought she knew. Contested inheritances were heard in the Court of Wills, and the Minister of Judicial Affairs had the right to appoint justices to that court. Hobart's new minister had promised Harless a deal. Rage blurred her vision a moment. She had never missed Kevel more. He would have known why Emily Saint-Foin glowered and Davor Vremont smirked. With a few low-voiced phrases, he could have made clear the relationship between Vremont Industrial Arts and the opportunities implicit in being the Colonial Affairs Minister. Buttons came down the long aisle to the table. Harless glared, and Buttons nodded. Then he smiled at Brunn, with the weary amity of someone who is too exhausted to fight.
I'm sorry. Business kept me away.
It's not your fault. Someone had to keep things going. I'm glad you did.
Buttons looked surprised at that.
Have you seen the agenda?
No, it wasn't posted. Mother said it was, but I couldn't find it.
What are you whispering about? It's almost time for the meeting.
Harless looked as confident as Buttons had looked worried, and his gaze passed over Brunn with none of the affection he had once lavished on her younger self. His son Kel leered at her, the sneer on his face making clear what he was thinking about.
My brother and I were exchanging greetings. Do you have a problem with that?
Buttons laid a hand on her wrist. She ignored it.
Well, he should have come earlier.
You never came at all.
I was at the funeral.
Other heads turned to look.
I wasn't talking about the funeral. Before, when I first got home.
Wasn't any need.
Brunn merely looked at him.
The first order of business is to vote on the proposed changes in the corporate bylaws.
I object. The proposals have not been submitted to the entire council in sufficient advance.
You're out of order. Besides, these changes are familiar to everyone. I presented them last session.
And they were voted down.
You're out of order. If you interrupt again, I'll have you thrown out. Now sit down. If you have anything worthwhile to say, you may say it during the discussion period.
Brunn felt her muscles tightening and took a deep breath. She had never seen anything like this in the Grand Council. From the shocked looks around her, no one else had either.
The full text is available at 34-888-16. The annotations are at 35-888-29. Please try to follow along as I go over them.
Brunn called up the two files and read quickly with growing dismay. Proposal to limit the franchise to those presently seated. Offspring to be seated as space allowed and in strict order of seniority. Proposal to take suitable measures to meet the threat of ageists.
What threat?
Proposal to create a special commission to investigate ageist influence in the regular space service. And another to investigate the inappropriate use of space service resources for private purposes. With a chill, Brunn realized that this was aimed at her rescue. Proposal to restrict access of news media. To restrict public access to records of Grand Council meetings. To reduce the quorum for voting on corporate bylaws. Every proposal had been presented before. The links told her when and by whom, and had been voted down before. But that had been with time for discussion, with men like her father and Kevil Mahoney to explain why the proposals were not in the best interests of the Familius as a whole. She could remember, now she was sitting here, that on the occasion of her taking her seat, Hobart Consuline standing up to propose limiting the franchise. On that occasion, he'd said the influence of the Grand Council was being diluted by mere fertility, that the unseated populace had lost respect for the Grand Council because all it took to get a seat was being born to the right parents. She sent a private message to Buttons. Was he always like this? Ever since I've had a seat, Buttons replied. Brunn tuned back in to what Hobart was saying.
While no one would wish such a vicious attack on anyone, it is perhaps fortunate for Lord Thornbuckle that he cannot stand before us to justify his actions.
Brunn stiffened and glanced at Buttons. His expression did not change, but his stylus pushed his pad so hard that a red light came up on the margin.
I am truly sorry if this distresses his daughter, who has chosen this time to take her place among us, but private feelings must defer to public weal in this case.
He looked up at her seat with an expression that made her want to wipe her face with a clean cloth. She expected the chamber to erupt in her defense, but no one moved or spoke. Hobart gave her a stiff little smile and nod and went on.
Since Lord Thornbuckle is dead and cannot reply, some might consider it unnecessary to detail the charges that might have been brought against him, but I believe in full and fair disclosure. The changes I propose to the bylaws are not trivial, and you need to know why I would suggest something so drastic. The fact is, the Familius Regnant is sick, on its deathbed, and if we don't act quickly, the patient could die. Will die, I believe, without our intervention.
Brunn glanced at Buttons. For an instant, with his mouth compressed, he looked exactly like his father in a rage. A light flashed on the panel, someone asking for the floor. Hobart shook his head and went on.
There's no time for discussion. We need to get this done. Get it out of the way so we can move forward.
There's always been time for discussion.
Brunn queried her panel. Minor branch of the Dacre sept, coded turquoise in the family database.
That's the trouble. All we do is talk.
Consuline, minor branch, Hobart's third younger brother. Lights flashed on Brunn's panel repeatedly. Brunn looked around, saw angry, flushed faces everywhere, all glaring tight-lipped at one another.
How did Hobart Consuline become Speaker?
Brunn raced through the database, trying to figure out the story behind the story. It had been the emergency Grand Council meeting, held in the hours after the assassination. Emergency meetings did not require the same quorum of seats, so response was limited to those attending in person or immediately available on an Ansible link. Only 23.2% of the Grand Council had been polled. Naturally, Lord Thornbuckle's family had not been present or available, nor had most of their friends. Hobart Consuline had received a majority of votes cast, but it amounted to only 15.8% of the whole. Yet he was acting as if he had a large majority of the entire council. Look behind the obvious, one of Brunn's instructors had taught her. Who benefits?
The Consulines, clearly. But how? They're already filthy rich, as rich or richer than the Barraclough sept. So why this grab for power? What more do they want?
We're going to vote now, right now, and get it behind us so we can move on to important external issues.
The warning chimes of vote in progress rang through the chamber, and Brunn's screen lit with the proposals.
Did Hobart really read through all of them?
Brunn struggled through the convoluted legalese, trying to figure out what they really meant. Kevil Mahoney had always said that legal language had more subtext than any fiction ever written, but she had not actually studied law. Some didn't look that bad. The reasoning as given had a plausible ring to it. She chewed on her lip, struggling to find the hidden meanings. Safer to vote against all of them, just in case. She hoped that was safer. She entered her votes and sat back to watch the others. Kel, tip of his tongue just showing, was marking his votes slowly, one by one. Harless had finished, and Hobart Consuline... Hobart was watching her, she realized. Time dragged on as they waited for others to complete their votes. Most seemed to have their minds made up ahead of time, but a few earnest souls were bent over their desks, clearly checking every word of every proposition and comparing it to other texts. The outcome of the voting was less a surprise than it might have been. The bylaws changes passed, and the next vote confirmed Hobart Consuline as Speaker for a normal term. The speeches had been confusing. On both sides of what was clearly becoming a deep division, speakers seemed choked with outrage, incoherent. Brunn kept quiet, watching carefully and making notes. Buttons, she saw, did the same. After the meeting ended, they went back to Appledale in the same car, by mutual consent talking only of things they could see from its windows. After supper, they settled to business, and finally, Brunn's big brother treated her as an equal.
I have to say, I was impressed with your performance today.
I didn't do anything.
You didn't pout, flounce, flirt, or storm. You sat there being attentive, intelligent, and menacing.
Menacing?
Didn't you see our new speaker watching you during the voting?
Yes, it made me itchy.
As well it should. The man's odd, Brunn. Well, Mother's gone to Cerealis, I hear. Are you staying here?
For now, yes. I'd planned to be the person on site to deal with the Grand Council. Unless you want to take it over.
Are you sure? Because if you can keep an eye on the Council, then I can concentrate on what our dear uncle was up to with the various family companies. It's hard without Kevil.
I'm sorry.
Buttons looked at her a long moment, and she knew that he knew what she meant. Sorry for everything. For becoming the issue by which the family lost ground, as well as the reason for their father's assassination.
Don't be sorry for being yourself. And don't be sorry for coming back. It'd be worse if you hadn't.
I don't see how.
I can think of a dozen ways. And so can you if you take the trouble. But that's not what matters right now. We've got attacks on all fronts. Where'd you put the babies, by the way? I don't want them used as hostages against us.
Cecilia DeMarctos took them somewhere. She's trustworthy.
Well... unless she puts them in a barn and tries to turn them into racehorses. Grooms I wouldn't mind, but you never know with her.
You're right, but I don't think she has them with her.
Good. As long as they aren't going to cause us trouble.
Not for another 10 or 12 years. I don't want to think about them as teenage boys.
If we have a familiar Seregnant in 10 years, we can worry about it then.
Brunn glanced at him. His face had gone somber, and he looked far older than his age.
Buttons, do you agree with Hobart about that?
That the Familius is in danger? Yes. That it's in danger because of lax leadership in the past? No. It's his policies that endanger it most. This business of restricting the franchise. One way we've had of relieving strain between families is that the small know they can enlarge by having more seat holders. That's let them take in outsiders as clients. Dad said the movement of power from one sept to another was a major factor in keeping the Familius stable. That's why they instituted the kingship originally.
Why can't Hobart see it?
I don't know. Back when I was a boy of maybe 10, and you were still in the nursery, I overheard some of the adults talking about how the new rejuve methods might change things politically. I remember Dad and Uncle Harless arguing. When I asked questions in school, nobody seemed to understand them. And later, when I was in the Royals, everyone talked as if the repeating rejuvenations were just a way to stay young for a normal lifespan, not an actual extension. It was, the year that Lupescu came to Cerealis, I think it was, where Charlie Winditson got drunk at a mess dinner and pointed out that if our parents never grew old, we had no reason to grow up. There was no future for us. Everyone laughed and drank, and I remember a sort of cold chill. I left the party early, called Sarah, and that's when we decided to marry.
I didn't know that.
Well, you were being wild at the time. Most of our set were. And I suddenly saw it myself. Our parents, he'd been more grown up, working in family business in some way, by the time they finished their education, sometimes even before. But their parents barely lived past their centuries and retired from family work in their 80s. The first rejuve upset that a little, but the new one... I came home and talked to Dad about it. He promised that he and Mother would resign their duties while I was still young. He transferred stock to me right after the Hunt Ball and encouraged me to be active in council as well as business.
And I thought you'd gone all stuffy.
So I had. But I didn't want to go from childhood to childhood. Rich enough to rejuve and be 20 or 30 all my life with nothing to do. That's no way to live.
But Uncle Harless, what about him?
He saw multiple rejuves as a way of maintaining family power. He wanted rejuve restricted to the seeded families at first. So did some others. But the proposal didn't pass. Then he tried an age restriction. No one under 80 should be eligible. That didn't pass either, of course. The ageists, who had used the biological problems with the earlier procedure to make repeated rejuves illegal, expected his support with the new procedure, but he didn't go along.
So, you're saying the population grew?
No, not just that. The birth rate in our set actually dropped, because people could wait to have children until they were 50 or 60 or older. It's the shape of the population that really changed, and the power structure. Age always did confer an advantage of experience, and now it could do so without losing any advantage of physical strength and energy. Younger people needed to find new opportunities because the old weren't dying, or even retiring. And, of course, people wanted rejuve, and especially when they found out how useful it was in some kinds of illness and injury. Everyone rich enough wanted it. And the Consulines wanted the profit.
Which meant expanding somehow. Like Dad's proposal to open new colonies.
As a temporary measure. Some others wanted to annex adjacent territories, but Dad opposed spatial expansion on the grounds that we couldn't serve all we had. And why alienate neighbors when we had planets within the Familius outline which could be settled? But he wanted more support for colonies, too. He'd been pushing the Colonial Office to make allowances for the less stable ecosystems of the worlds now being opened. That translates into concessions for the companies and families purchasing settlement licenses.
Oh, I don't know enough to follow this.
Well, you can learn. Basically, the longer a world is allowed to stabilize after the terraforming treatments, the more easily it can be colonized. Until recently, this required such long-term investment that very few families would attempt it. When the Familius Regnant came together, the Council agreed to a joint investment at one world a year. We only know how much better the old treated planets are because of the Lost Worlds.
Paradise? Babylon? Oasis?
Yes. All treated in the second wave of outreach, and all lost to the records for centuries in the Cluster Wars. So they had between 700 and 800 years of stabilization after treatment. Nothing like the mature ecosystem of a planet in its natural state, but for human purposes, vastly superior to most of the worlds we used. Only now are others approaching the quality. The scouts who found paradise found mature forests with 300-year-old timber, grasslands with deep soil, not a shallow dark layer, estuaries rich in shellfish, rather than a few colonies that had still to be nurtured. A stable climate, reasonably predictable. Nobody had known what difference another 5 centuries could make. If we could let all terraformed planets have that long, colonists would have a much easier time. Not easy, it's never easy, but easier.
But temporary, you said? Was he thinking of enforcing a limit on reproduction or on rejuve?
I'm not sure. He talked about both from time to time. But the Familius is so complicated. You know, we have planets populated mostly by free birthers, and others with mostly zero growthers, and probably 8 dozen religions, not even counting the fringes. Any policy one group approves will offend someone else. And meanwhile, the percentage of the population that had been rejuved was going up every year. Every survey taken showed that rejuvenates wanted and expected to rejuve again.
I wonder how the Grand Nassi have handled it. They've had the process as long as we have, and they aren't falling apart.
I don't know. It's a good question. Do they have our diversity of beliefs?
And I don't know that one. This is seriously complicated stuff, Buttons.
It's a seriously complicated universe, and we are right in the middle of a whirlpool if we don't figure it out.
Buttons gave Brawn a long, steady look.
You're a grown-up now, and you volunteered for the job of being council watchdog for our family. This is what it takes.
Being a dizzy blonde was such fun.
In the working passenger's mess of the Jessamine Essence, the men had played the newsvid cube of the assassination and aftermath 3 times already, without more than a few muttered cuss words. Then one of them, the oldest, shut off the player.
So we're too late and somebody got him first. So what do we do?
Get the rest of them. If he's dead, maybe they won't be watching so close. I could take that yellow-haired slut.
But I keep thinking about the chilling, Dan. By rights, they should be ourn.
Ben's right. Somebody stomps a rattler's head, no matter how it squirms around, it's not gonna attack nobody. We don't need to be going around killing people like criminals. But getting our chilling back, that's a good thing to do.
But how we gonna find them? Now, supposing they already been sent to new homes.
Dan held up his hand.
We don't know that yet. First thing is, we'll look for them in a group. Probably we'll hear if we keep our ears open. Every port we come to. Now mind, nobody gets drunk like that idiot on Zenebra.
They all knew about that. A whole shipload had been captured.
No fights, no arguments. We have a mission. A new mission. And that's the rules. Got it?
Yes, sir.
The next day, the Jesse came into Goldwyn Station, and the working passengers debarked after checking off their assignments with the captain. For once, working passengers had actually worked without complaint, and the captain added the optimal minimal pay chit to their goodbye handshake. Whatever anyone said about fanatics, he always liked to hire the pious brotherhoods because he could count on them to work hard and keep their fingers off the cargo. The Goldwyn Spacers Services Station, or S3, offered a variety of cheap lodging, food, and drink. This was an all-civilian station, rarely visited by RSS ships, and the diversity of Familius spacefaring cultures showed up in decor and cuisine both. The men followed their noses to something with a familiar smoky meat odor and settled at one long table. On one wall, a newsvid showed scenes from some business meeting, but they didn't recognize any of the faces or references. Then, a face they did recognize, a blonde woman with short, curly hair.
Any comments on the outcome of the meeting, Sarah Meager Thornbuckle?
No. You do realize our family is still in mourning.
Yes, Sarah, but what do you think of a consuline as speaker?
Excuse me.
She turned away, and the camera followed, showing her getting into a long, dark maroon car.
Damn, it's her!
The waitress, in red checks and blue denim, slapped menus down in front of them.
You men are all the same, just because she's young and rich and pretty.
We'll have chili, all of us. A bowl of chili each, and some crackers.
Dan's glance silenced the others, who looked ready to say things they must not say.
And some beer?
No, not yet anyway.
Not until they'd found out what they wanted, where the women and children were. If they could find them and bring them home, even some of them, they'd be honored among men. Maybe even more than if they'd managed to kill the speaker themselves. That would stop the Rangers of Texas True from saying they were nothing but a bunch of wifeless drifters causing trouble.
Look!
Ben touched Dan's arm and nodded at the news vid. There it was again, the picture that had infuriated them all. Women and children in the traditional clothes walking down a corridor from a ship's hatch, guarded by battle-armored troops of the Familius fleet. Dan had trouble following the accent of the newsvid announcer, but he did understand Baskar Station. He didn't know if that was where the women were in the picture or where they were now, but they could always go and find out. Somewhere there'd be a bar and men talking, and someone would know if he asked the right questions. Hobart Consoline ran his hand over the wide, gleaming surface of the desk. His desk now, as it had been Bunny Thornbuckle's, and before that, Chemtree Altman's, and felt a glow of satisfaction. His Delphine now had the suite Miranda had occupied, and to him had come every perquisite he had once envied, from the skilled, silent staff to the deference of those who had been his peers and were now his subordinates. He had worried when he saw Brun and Buttons both at the Thornbuckle tables, but neither of them had offered to speak, and however they had voted, the Count had gone his way. Their own uncle supported him, for a specific reason, but that didn't matter. He would have appointed new ministers for legal affairs and internal affairs anyway. He would have appointed new judges. There were certain legal actions in progress within his own sept, which made that prudent. If Harless benefited, and assumed it was all for his own benefit, well, that was a cheap profit, and he had never scorned a cheap profit in his life. He leaned back in the chair and gave himself up to reverie for a few minutes. He was relatively young, and with the aid of repeated rejuvenations, he would remain young and powerful. They had seen what happened with a succession of speakers generations back, and then what happened when they made leadership hereditary with the Altmans. Prosperity had followed prosperity, an upward trend with only minor adjustments. But no one had yet seen what he would show them, the stability and wealth that would come with one leader who would never fade into senility.
Year after year, decade after decade, here to serve and protect, to guide and lead.
Hobart sat up, scowling. That was the future. But now he had to deal with the problems his predecessors had left him.
My lord, Colonel Bydarlin, head of the Special Security Unit, would like a meeting.
Send him in.
He would show them how hard a real leader worked. He would be tireless for the good of the realm, as he had been tireless for the good of his family and his sept. And realistically speaking, given the importance of his sept in the economy of the realm, what was good for the Consulines could not help but be good for the rest. At least most of them. Bydarlin came in with a crisp salute and heel click that convinced Hobart the man was efficient.
But is he smart? Is he tireless?
My lord, I thought you might like to be brought up to date on the investigation into the death of Lord Thornbuckle.
It was those New Tex terrorists. I can't imagine why you haven't caught them yet.
My lord, the preliminary investigations have found no trace of anyone from any of the worlds on which they operate being on Castle Rock since the Rangers were brought to this system for trial.
Then the investigators are incompetent. What does it take, a bright red stripe painted on someone's head? They threatened to kill the Speaker, and the Speaker was shot. What more do you want?
Bydarlin looked at him in a way that made Hobart feel uncomfortable.
Evidence for a start.
You have evidence. Lord Thornbuckle's dead body. The damage done to Sir Mahoney, to the vehicle.
Yes, my lord. But none of that points to the New Texas God-fearing militia. We've no indication on travel manifests, on hotel registers, that they were here.
If they weren't here, they must have hired someone.
According to our best sources, they do not hire criminals to work for them. And what we know about the types of weapons used does not fit with them either. They like direct confrontation. It'd be far more likely to walk up to an intended victim on the street.
Excuses. Although, if it wasn't the militia, I can think of another disruptive element it might be.
Yes, my lord. Anything you could suggest?
Ageists. Lord Thornbuckle was a rejuvenant, and so was his wife, a multiple.
Bydarlin's gaze shifted to Hobart's ear.
These are jewelry, Colonel. I support rejuvenation, of course. Any sensible man does.
and a man in my position must wear his colors, so to speak. I will rejuvenate when I need to in another 10 years or so. I'm quite a bit younger than Lord Thornbuckle was. In the meantime, these rings...
Hobart touched his ear.
These rings reassure the older rejuvenants that I am serious when I support their interests.
I see, sir. And do you think it possible that ageists assassinated Lord Thornbuckle because he was rejuvenated? Does this mean you think they will attack you?
I don't think it was ageists. I think it was the New Tex Militia, as I told you. But if I'm wrong about that, I'd look at the ageists next.
I was hoping, my lord, that you might share some insights into possible elements among the seated families. Perhaps Lord Thornbuckle had aroused a particular animosity there. He seemed a popular speaker, but there's always someone.
Hobart waved his hand.
Minor resentments, perhaps. Certainly there were those who felt he misused Familius' resources in going after his daughter the way he did. A number of us thought so and expressed ourselves at the time. But I'm not aware, and I wouldn't be necessarily, since I've little to do with the internal workings of Barraclough Sept, of anything serious enough to cause someone to kill him.
Very good, sir. Thank you, my lord, for your time.
Catch those killers, Colonel, and I'll see you get a medal.
Instead of the eager grin Hobart expected, By Darlin gave him a dark, brooding look before turning away. Strange fellow. Perhaps not as efficient as he had seemed. Several days later, Hobart found himself glaring at the same desk he had coveted so much. That was the natural result of having to deal with obstructive fools, he told himself. A man had a right to have ministers he could work with.
Now why should any of Bunny Thornbuckle's appointees expect to stay in office if they're going to cause me trouble?
They should have learned from his first dismissals and replacements, but still they obstructed him. They would have to go, root and branch. He was not going to deal with any more of this insubordination. Hobart considered his options.
Who should be replaced first?
Defense had been making noises lately about rejuvenation in the enlisted ranks, something about aged NCOs going crazy or something. Their idiot medical branch had put a hold on all rejuvenations and seemed to be determined to investigate thoroughly. He'd pointed out to Irian Solinari that it would be expensive and inefficient to hold a prolonged investigation into something like that, and that it would be better to cut their losses and simply discharge the affected personnel as medically unfit. But Solinari argued. Solinari did nothing but argue, Hobart thought, remembering that Solinari had also argued with Bunny, who had appointed him. Just a difficult personality, and not one suited to a responsible position like Minister of Defense. If Solinari went, if he had his own choice as defense, then he could also ease out the more difficult of the admirals. Perhaps their rejuvenations would fail. Those had all been done with the original Guernsey drugs, so if they failed, it would take the burden of public opinion off the Patchcock connection. They didn't actually have to fail. If only Fleet could be persuaded to take them off active duty out of concern about the rejuvenations. Right now, the medical branch and senior officers were being completely unreasonable, and Solinari was backing them up. Or stirring them up. He wasn't sure which. Solinari definitely had to go. He opened his private pad and began drafting a letter to Solinari, explaining his reasoning. He didn't want to be harsh, but the man had to realize that he was just not qualified. And even if he had been, his negative attitude, his contentious nature, made him unfit.
More in sorrow than anger.
Not that Solinari had any friends worth worrying about. A bunch of backbiting, acid-tongued non-entities in the minor families, that was all. They'd soon find out what they were dealing with.
Oh.
Admiral Vida Serrano rarely concerned herself with civilian matters unless they seemed likely to precipitate a war. Certainly, Lord Thornbuckle's assassination had been shocking, but she expected that it wouldn't make much difference in the long run. Someone else would be elected, a few ministers might change, and the inertia of the very large organization would keep everything going very much as usual. What could be frustrating when she wanted to make a change reassured her when she wanted stability. Her business, as she saw it, was to make sure her command was ready to deal with any exterior threat, which might see the momentary confusion as an opportunity to cause trouble. To that end, she had put herself on the list for updates on the rejuvenation problem, and had come to the same conclusion as the first Blue Ribbon panel charged with investigating it. A bad batch of rejuvenation drugs, purchased because they were slightly less expensive, and almost certainly manufactured at the Patchcock plant she had seen. The solution was also clear. Repeat rejuvenations with clean drugs for those who had not yet suffered significant damage, and supportive care for those who had, for whom another rejuvenation would mean prolongation of senile misery. She had co-signed the report when it was forwarded upstairs, and had also co-signed a letter suggesting that the manufacturer bear the expense of the repeat rejuvenations and the supportive care. And nothing had been done. The update list had disappeared. She'd asked headquarters and been told it was discontinued pending investigation of security problems. Headquarters had suddenly cut off funding for repeat rejuvenations without explaining why. Surely they understood how important it was. Fleet needed those people back at work, not to mention the individual's own need to be saved from senility and death. Vita approved as many rejuvenations as she could out of her discretionary fund, but she didn't have the money for all of them. She thought of contacting Marta Caterina Sainz, whose pharmaceuticals she trusted, but headquarters had put a gag order on rejuvenation. She wasn't even supposed to discuss it internally. Going outside would be grounds for court-martial, if she were found out. She wished she knew where all this nonsense was coming from, whether it was someone in Fleet, someone in the government. The Grand Council meeting the day after the funeral had elected Hobart Marathal Consoline as the new head of government, and he had appointed some new people to various defense-related committees. But Irian Solinari was still Minister of Defense, and he'd always been solid. She toyed with the idea of contacting him directly, but admirals who got involved with ministers went up like a rocket and down like the stick, in her experience. It was almost as bad for a career as marrying into a seated family. Most of these new appointees were only names to Vita Serrano. The Consolines and Moralines had been involved in the Patchcock mess, everyone knew that much. But she had searched the databases a long time to find Hobart Marathal Consoline, and then the only information she could get was a short official biography on the occasion of his taking his seat in council. Nothing in it indicated why the other families would choose him, unless it were a general desire to repudiate Thornbuckle and all his friends. She had reached this point in what had become an all-too-familiar reverie.
Admiral, there's a courier here from headquarters with a hand carry.
Hand carries were an outdated pain, in Vita's opinion, but some of the mossy backs at headquarters believed in them, especially the chief of personnel. Maybe it was the information she'd requested on the progress of other sectors in returning their rejuvenated senior NCOs to active duty.
Send him in.
To her surprise, Harris Serrano's acquaintance, Commander Lavati, Arash or Aram, came in with the case under his arm. Not Commander, she realized, as the obviously new star on his collar twinkled. Admiral Minor.
Congratulations. I hadn't heard about your promotion.
She hadn't heard that a promotion board was even meeting. She should have heard. Another tiny alarm rang in her head. He looked shamefaced, almost as if he wanted to dig a guilty toe in her carpet.
Admiral, I'm sorry to be the bearer of bad news, but thank you anyway.
Excuse me?
I don't know if you heard that we have a new Minister of Defense?
No. Solinari's out?
Yes. Out and gone. Nobody had a chance to talk to him. The word is, he left Castle Rock and went home, and he's not giving interviews to anyone.
I see.
Vita wondered what they had done to Solinari, who had never shrunk from interviews, who had spoken his mind in spite of everyone. Tried to guess what could send a Solinari back to whatever world he'd come from, and put a lock on his tongue. She felt cold, considering.
The short of it is that the new speaker didn't like what Solinari told him about the rejuvenation problem, and he's appointed someone who will do what he's told without question. The new speaker does not believe that the problem with NCO rejuvenations is entirely the fault of the pharmaceuticals.
Of course it is! The data clearly show...
Data can be manipulated. The speaker seems convinced that the data were manipulated, perhaps by special interest groups influencing scientists and the research facilities.
He wants the data manipulated.
That's not for me to say.
Lavati paused, and Vita stared at him, taking in the warning she'd just been given.
And what else, then?
Given the possibility, yet to be investigated, that the failure of the NCO rejuvenations was not entirely due to problems with the drugs, but to some idiosyncratic response, right now they're talking about the level of inbreeding in Fleet families, I understand, though you didn't hear that from me.
As if their families weren't inbred.
We are not registered embryos, so they said. Given that possibility, they say, then there is concern about the stability of rejuvenations of senior officer personnel as well. It has been decided that all rejuvenations of Fleet personnel must be investigated thoroughly, beginning with those of flag rank.
Vita Serrano stiffened in her chair.
They can't be serious.
Yes, sir, they are. They've extended the medical hold to all personnel, officers included, and specifically including flag officers, whose rejuvenations are more than 10 years old. They're to be relieved of active duty until medical evaluations are complete.
But...
To his credit, Levati looked almost as unhappy as she felt. If he felt any triumph, he was concealing it well.
Admiral, I know it's unprecedented. This whole mess is unprecedented. It is leave with pay. At least full pay for those below commander, half pay for those above.
Which is nearly every officer involved. Besides, they know my rejuve is stable. I was one of the first. It's been over 25 years.
Yes, sir, but...
And who do they think is going to take over all of a sudden? The losers they didn't want to waste rejuve on? Or even promote? No. Don't answer that. I didn't say it. You didn't hear it. Blast!
Vita swung her chair away from her desk, staring through the bulkhead into decades of memory. All lay clear to her inward sight, vista after vista. Crisp images, faces, names, relationships. They were wrong. They had to be wrong. Nothing blurred her mind. She swung back.
Fine, then. I'll take myself off duty, hike down to medical. They can take a look and put me back on.
No, sir. Please. Would the Admiral look at the orders?
Which you didn't draft, I presume. All right.
Vita looked at them, read them carefully, every word of every old-fashioned paper sheet. Worse than bad. Mandatory immediate release from active duty. Immediate replacement by officers specified. In her case, Admiral Minor Levati. Immediate surrender of all communications devices, encryption-decryption devices, data access devices.
I'm sorry, Admiral. I think it's unreasonable and ridiculous to make flag officers leave their quarters and their duty stations so fast.
Vita was past the first flash of anger now, and her brain had moved into combat speed computation.
Makes sense if someone really wants us gone, though. Rush us out, make sure we can't contact our friends still on active duty, except by monitored channels. Make sure we have no access to files.
I have a room in the transient officer's bay. I see no reason to enforce this to the letter.
Vita looked up and caught sympathy on his face. Harris had said he had his good points.
Don't you? Then you're more of a fool than I ever thought, young man. When the wind changes, so must the sails. If you don't enforce your orders, you won't last long. I'll be out of here by the deadline.
Yes, but I'm not even sure what I'm supposed to do.
Vita gave him a wide Serrano grin, full teeth, and he paled, the freckles standing out.
You'll do your job, son, the same way I did mine, and learn it the same way, too. Scary to get what you always wanted, isn't it? Now, if you'll excuse me, I need to clear my desk. Sandy, come on in. We have a situation.
Within the hour, she had started the process that would transfer command of Sector 7 to Admiral Minor Levati. No big change of command ceremony, because there was no time for it if they were to make the deadline. She called in her staff, advised them of the orders, and had them start briefing Levati, who had just come from Sector 5, about the peculiarities of Sector 7. While they did so, she began peeling out her personal files from the official ones stored under her codes. She would definitely take with her the files on rejuvenation, for instance. Should she offer Levati copies? No. If he were found to have them, he might get in trouble. What about the scant information she'd collected on the new powers in the Grand Council? Maybe. Lists of family members on active duty, people from whom she might legitimately, well, almost legitimately, seek information. All the Admiral Serrano had been rejuved, so all would be affected. From Davor, now a third year at the Academy, to Gossen. her nose wrinkled at the thought of trying to work with Gossen, who was one of the rare light-skinned Serranos, though that was only the most obvious of her problems. The list included 17, because Harris's parents had just retired. Baron's mother was still on active duty, but his father had retired to take over as the Serrano family's agent.
Vita, it's Kadar Levati. Have you heard this ridiculous order taking rejuved admirals off duty?
Just saw the orders, Gadar. One of yours brought them to me, in fact. Nice, shiny new star young Arash has.
Well, what are we going to do about it?
I don't know about you, but I'm going to take myself off active duty. Were you one of the experimentals, too?
Yes. And there's not a thing wrong with my brain but the smoke coming off it from this nonsense.
Gadar, this is no time...
To start trouble, I know, but at a time like this with Thornbuckle gone, we need experienced leaders.
If we've done our job, our juniors can take over.
You're an optimist. By the way, what do you hear from Copper Mountain?
Nothing. Should I?
Well, you know, my brother Arcot's in the Judicial Division.
Yes?
He's been investigating the records of prisoners sent to Copper Mountain's secure facilities, that Stack Islands thing, because that's one of the places that Lepescu stashed your niece's crew.
And?
And he turned up something interesting. Lepescu's juniors, the ones too far down to have been caught with their hands in the honey jar after he was killed, have been cycling through Stack Islands. Not his prisoners, but his guards. Not all the guards, of course, but some of them.
Oh, my.
If you wanted to recruit desperate and dangerous personnel, even those who serve their terms and aren't discharged are going to have that mark against them, you could hardly do better than to start there.
And you think they're up to something, of course. Any idea what?
Another mutiny? Perhaps a breakaway?
In service to whom? What kind of financial backing do they have?
I haven't been able to find out anything. I've always rather wondered if Lepescu wasn't close to the Moral Lines, given his involvement in Patchcock.
He made things worse. The whole thing rebounded.
Yes, but in the long run, it cemented Moral Line control. Got the Familius as a whole bad publicity.
You didn't say anything about that at the time.
No, I didn't realize it at the time. I was all the way over in One, chatting up those Lone Star Confederation diplomats. I hate staff rotations.
Vita didn't rise to that bait.
It's only recently, after your... adventure there, that I began looking into it.
Well, there's nothing we can do now but go home like good little children. I hope they realize what an opportunity this is for foreign interests. Not to say anything against your family member, Gadar, but your new Admiral Minor almost turned up his toes when he realized he was about to be responsible for the sector most likely to be attacked by the New Tex Militia with only 36 hours of OJT.
My heart bleeds. I hope these are only temporary ranks, because the instant they check us out medically, I'm going to be back in my office.
I hope it's quick. But if someone wanted to get rid of us, or some of us, all they'd have to do is delay the medical.
You Serranos are so cheerful.
You Levadis are so lively.
Vita could not remember a time in her adult life when she had had nothing specific to do for days on end. She'd taken leave, of course, but she'd always had plans. A trip to take, a course, a family crisis that needed her time and talents. She had money enough. She hadn't spent all her salary since she made lieutenant, and her investments had prospered. She could live quite well on half pay. It was the idleness that bothered her, the sense of being cut off from her family. Well, she'd go home then, to the Serrano compound on Melander, that source of all, or at least many, of the Serrano family. Making reservations on a civilian ship was annoying. She tried to laugh at herself for expecting people to jump when she said hop, but it wasn't easy. She'd so often thought of civilians as disorganized, but when you didn't have a staff... She grumbled at herself repeatedly as she arranged to ship this and store that and decided what to carry on and what to stow in cargo. She recognized other flag officers the first day on the ship. By mutual, unspoken consent, they avoided each other. Though all wore uniforms at first, and of course they were entitled to do so on leave, she and most of the others changed to civilian clothes early in the voyage. Melander's orbital station had grown since she'd last seen it, but was still smaller than the huge combined fleet civilian stations she was used to. She saw plenty of people in uniform, but they ignored her. Ignored her just because she wasn't wearing hers. She glowered at them anyway. Two of them, at least, were Serrano's. She caught a north side shuttle, checked the arrival station weather, and pulled out a warmer jacket. Early spring on Melander would be colder than the regulated temperature on a ship or station. The Serrano family compound lay along the shore of a lake, inaccurately named Serenity, since it seemed always ruffled by the breeze channeled up from the sea between the hills. All the fleet families who built compounds tended to the same organization. Separate houses for the guardians with young children, those with older children, for the transient younger officers, for the senior officers on long leave, for those in retirement. Flag officers each had an apartment, which might be used for a special guest when its owner was not in residence. Vida had never seen hers, having qualified for it since her last visit, but she knew it would be there, furnished with the things she had sent home over the years. It smelled of wax and wood and leather, and the clean, sharp scent of top-grade electronics. It was just as she'd imagined it, filled with souvenirs from all over the Familius, arranged attractively. And she hated it. The apartment was bigger than her quarters on station, but it felt cramped and closed in a way that ship compartments never did. She glared out the window at the lake. A walk, then, to work off this bad temper. On the way downstairs, she saw Sabatino, the other Serrano flag officer, and her distant cousin.
I hate planets.
So do I.
They had never been close friends, but they were both Serrano admirals and thus had common interests.
I'm going up in the mountains for a week or so, leaving tomorrow.
Vida remembered that he had always liked wilderness camping.
I'm going for a walk. Dinner?
Might as well.
He waved and went on into his apartment. Out of doors felt entirely too exposed. The wind, no proper ventilation current, whipped the lake surface into choppy little waves and tried to push Vida sideways. Clouds rushed by overhead, and behind the clouds was that opaque lid which groundsiders insisted was beautiful, hiding the stars. She had liked the planet well enough growing up on it. She hadn't minded the blues and grays and mauves and pinks of the sky then, or the many shades of cloud. Vida pushed herself to walk faster, down the pebbled walk, across the road, to the footpath by the lake. Far out, bright sails glinted in red and yellow against the water. One thing about planets, you could walk a long way without retracing your steps. She walked herself breathless, heading east, well past the end of the Serrano estate. There had been a small cluster of shops down here at one time, where a public boat ramp gave access to the lake for those who didn't have waterfront property. Recovering her breath while waiting in a line of children for a drink and a snack, she chose tea and a cinnamon pastry, not the sweet drinks and cream buns the children were buying. She recovered her sense of humor as well.
Planets are not that bad, all things considered.
Vida settled on a bench, protected from the wind by one of the shops, and looked at the hills behind the estates across the road. She had wandered there as a child, splashing in the creeks and exploring little hidden valleys. She had run down here, hot and thirsty, to buy the same sweet drinks.
Not bad at all, planets. If you're there by choice.
She would have to find something useful to do. With that resolve, she started back to the family compound, and by the time she arrived, she was quite ready for dinner with Sabatino. They chatted about music and art, her collection of modern prints, and his of music recordings. He invited her to come hear Maliki Vusuba's new bassoon concerto in his apartment, and she spent a pleasanter evening than she'd expected, arguing about the merits of that controversial work. The next morning, however, he was gone, and she still hadn't decided what to do. She arranged a few ornaments, checked for a third time that everything had been put away neatly. The noise from outside brought her to the window of the second bedroom. The smallest Serrano children played in the garden between the houses, as she had done, screaming and laughing the way children always did. Vida looked down on their playscape with its ramps and towers and bridges, and found it hard to believe she had ever been that noisy. Now that she had noticed them, the noise seemed to pierce her head with little needles. Maybe the archives would be quieter. She went downstairs, and down again, into the underground library that housed the oldest documents the Serrano family owned. Rows of Serrano biographies. Vida reread Roger Xavier Serrano, one of her favorites. He had every attribute of a hero, including having made love to and won the heart of a beautiful heroine as brave as himself, and Millicent Serrano, born blind but gifted with extraordinary spatial abilities. She'd always meant to read about her own great-uncle, Alcandor, who had managed to get thrown out of the fleet for smuggling a tricorn vermuge onto a ship as a prank, and had then been readmitted because no one else could get it off. That story in the official biography wasn't nearly as good as she remembered from his tales on the front porch of Rest House when he was a retired commander with a gimpy leg and a strange green spot on his arm. The official biography didn't mention the Vermuge's lust for coffee, for instance, or the creature's curious mating behavior. Vida spent several days browsing the family biographies before she tired of that and looked around for something else. Battle reports. She'd seen all she wanted of battle reports. Service records, leave records, slim volumes of verse by Serranos who thought themselves poets. She opened one of these. Either Amory David Serrano wasn't a very good poet, or the language had changed a lot in the past 200 years. Mercedes Esperanza, on the other hand, had written erotic verses that should, Vida thought, have ignited the whole archive. But Mercedes had died young of a typical poetic fever. What kind of space commander would she have made? Stories, even. A few Serranos had written fiction, most of it clearly intended for children, and most of it, to Vida's taste anyway, pretty bad. Carlo and the Starship was nothing more than a child's tour of a passenger ship, with a biddable child asking obvious questions and a friendly puppy answering them. She passed by Carlo and the power plant, and Carlo goes to the mountains, and almost missed Long Ago on Altiplano.
Altiplano?
Her grandson's fiancé's homeworld. She pried it out of the tightly squeezed group of skinny children's books. Its pages had turned brown and brittle. The illustrations were not drawn in, but pasted on. Ancient, faded flat picks.
Long ago on Altiplano, a great family ruled.
So they had. The family the Serranos had been bound to.
A beautiful world with magnificent snow-capped mountains and great golden plains of grass. To this world, the Garcia MacDonalds brought their people, who prospered there and spread across the fertile land, and their loyal guards and protectors, the brave Serranos, watched the sky above them and kept their ships safe from piracy.
That too, Vida knew. The Serranos had been their space militia. Someone else had been their ground militia.
But treachery surrounded them. They were betrayed by those they trusted to guard them.
Vida felt a chill. They hadn't been betrayed by Serranos.
By their soldiers on the planet.
That was better.
And they were all killed. The mothers and fathers and all the little children, because of the wickedness of the rebels and traitors. And that is why when we say our prayers, we do not ask for blessing upon the people of Altiplano. What an odd book for a child.
It was more like a diatribe, like a memoir. She looked on the other side of the gap in the row, but found only Carlo visits the observatory and Helen starts school, followed by three little Serranos visit the seashore. Nothing else with the same faded brown binding. Vida took her find over to the table and paged back through it. Very, very odd. Hand-printed, of course, and the flat picks glued on with something that had bled through. They were all blurry and faded, but one appeared to show a house, and another a face. The rest might have been landscapes. The pasted-in pictures made the book fatter than its spine suggested. No wonder the whole row had been wedged tight. Vida flipped every page, looking for any identifying mark. One of the flat picks fell off, and the paper folded behind it with it. She looked at it. Thin, almost translucent, brown on the folds. It had been there for a very, very long time. Perhaps she should get the family librarian. She might damage it by unfolding it. But she couldn't resist peeking. Back at Castle Rock, Cecilia was surprised to find that Miranda had left not just the palace, but the planet. She checked the net and found that Brunn was the only family member on planet. Brunn had moved to Appledale, the Thornbuckle family estates on Castle Rock. Cecilia had always liked Appledale, with its pleasant view of rolling fields and orchards. She called and, as she'd expected, Brunn invited her out to stay. Brunn met her at the front door, quickly directed the staff to take her luggage upstairs, and then, even on the way to the handsome downstairs morning room, frothed over with indignation about Hobart Consoline, who had gotten himself elected Speaker of the Table of Ministers.
"Hobart? He's not that bad, is he? He was always polite to me. I never had that much to do with him, but..."
"Hobart is a raging bully."
Brunn waved Cecilia to a comfortable chintz-covered chair and threw herself into another.
"Just wait till you hear."
She took off at a conversational gallop, surprising Cecilia with her grasp of family relationships. Cecilia wondered if the girl had been listening behind closed doors and actually paying attention when she seemed just a young fluffhead. It was always possible. This was, after all, the same Brunn who had engineered her escape from the nursing home.
"I wouldn't have believed it. Are you sure? I mean, he's always been a bit pig-headed, but most of us are from time to time."
A maid had brought in trays of pastries and sliced fruits and pots of coffee and tea. Cecilia filled a little plate with apple slices and munched. They were just as crisp and flavorful as she remembered.
"He slapped down Great Uncle Victor in the meeting. Victor! And Stefan didn't say a word. He's found excuses to get rid of most of the ministers, replacing them with his own people. And now that he has the votes, it doesn't really matter if a few of Dad's are left."
Brunn was ignoring the food so far, but Cecilia took one of the ginger curls as well.
"What about Harless?"
"He's bought Harless. I suspect with the help of his new Minister of Judicial Affairs, Norm Radson. You know how helpful or unhelpful the courts can be in estate cases."
"Indeed I do."
"Well, it is amazing how many rulings have changed in Harless's favor since Norm took over that ministry. Without Kevil Mahoney or access to his private files, and nobody, not even George, knows the access codes to Kevil's files."
Cecilia did. She thought back to their last conversation, when they had discussed her own tangled legal problems in the wake of being declared incompetent. Kevil had trusted her with the voice codes for just this sort of situation.
"Has anyone tried to have Kevil declared incompetent?"
"Not that I know of. George certainly hasn't. Why?"
"Why not? If Kevil is still incapacitated and unable to access his own files."
"I mean, we could use the information, but we're not going to press for that. Not after what happened to you."
"Is he conscious?"
"Yes, but he can't seem to remember much or concentrate. His doctors don't advise rejuvenation because of the extent of the neurological damage and the recent discoveries of what went wrong with fleet rejuvenations."
"I hadn't heard about that."
"No, it came out after you left. Some of the senior NCOs, the chiefs, started going senile. I actually saw one like that back on Copper Mountain before I left and all the rest happened. Memory loss, irrational thought processes. I mentioned it to Esme, in fact, but then we had that fight. Anyway, there were more of them, a lot more of them. And when they did some research, they found some flaws in the process. They've put about half of the flag officers on indefinite leave because they were rejuved. Just in case. None of them had shown symptoms yet, unless you count the Pescue."
"Flaws in the process or in the drugs themselves? Remember what happened on Patchcock?"
"That's what I thought at first. Just a batch of bad drugs. I raised a formal question in council, the second meeting that is, not the first. But Hobart claimed I was just doing it to embarrass him, to use it as an excuse for family rivalry. And one of his bootlickers got up and sprouted a whole involved line about genetic susceptibility and the inbred genome of fleet families."
"What did Venezia Moraline say?"
"She wasn't there. And I can't get a hold of Harris or Vita Serrano either. Both Serrano admirals were taken off active duty. Fleet personnel officers claim not to know where they are. Harris has a ship, but it's out on patrol or something, inaccessible to civilians. Which doesn't make sense, because I've been able to contact Esme, and she's on an SAR, way off at the remote end of familiar space.
How is Esme?
Oh, pining for Baron, worried about his new tech's wives. Apparently Fleet Accounting has garnished Baron's entire salary to help support them. And she's getting a little bored with the SAR, I gather. Also, she's found out that Fleet doesn't think Landbride should marry Fleet officers.
But she is a Landbride. What do they think of that?
Yes. It's funny, really. She says they've got it all wrong, and she didn't want to be one anyway. But it's tied up in the paperwork for her to marry Baron, even if he weren't going broke trying to support all those new tech's women. Oh, poor Esme. It's her first time in love. I remember how I pined for Tommy Rakeseller. First time I had it bad. And I thought the universe was dreadfully unfair because his parents sent him off to camp. Oh, I know this is more serious, but it's really hard on her.
And Baron?
Baron's at the other end of our universe, escorting a Lone Star Confederation ranger back here.
What?
Yes, they warned me, or rather, Waltrowd did, that crazy professor who's hanging around the new tech's women. It never occurred to anyone official that introducing me to a ranger might upset me. Apparently, Hobart's new Minister of Foreign Affairs decided to shut the wrong barn door long after the horse had returned and froze all the assets of Lone Star Confederation citizens and closed the border.
But Lone Star had nothing to do with it.
You know that. My father knew that, and even I know that. But all Hobart had to hear was the word Texas and the fact that they were ageists, as he calls it. The Lone Star Confederation has been a reasonable trading partner for centuries. They were understandably annoyed and insisted on sending someone to educate us.
Cecilia leaned back in her chair. You know, Brunn, I find it hard to believe that you, of all people, are being this politically minded.
Me too. I keep thinking, well, this is not me. This is my evil twin. But one thing I did learn in all that hell is what happens if you don't pay attention. So Mother's gone back to Cerealis to dig out all of Dad's files that she can. Some of them were never transferred here, and try to stave off Uncle Hollis's grab for the family properties. And here I am.
Yes, I see.
And you did find a good home for the twins?
Yes, a very good home. They will be loved and cared for.
Good. I thought after you left that I should have suggested Rafaela. But then she's been cleaning up my messes for far too long. I'm glad you found someone else.
You said a new Minister of Foreign Affairs. Who would that be?
Minor family. Major Payne. Pedar Origamos. You probably never heard of him.
As a matter of fact, I have. He has event horses. I beat his entry in the Huerin this year.
Good. I wish you'd managed to trample him at the same time. Oh, you should see him fawning on Hobart and Hobart lapping it up. Oh, the man has absolutely no background in diplomatic service, no experience in dealing with foreign entities. He thinks any political system which doesn't embrace rejuvenation is corrupt and probably about to attack us. He's already managed to insult the Crescent Worlds, and they're ours. Oh, and worse than that, he thinks he's the right person to comfort widows. He keeps hinting to me that he would make a fine stepfather.
Brunn mimed gagging. Cecilia grabbed for yet another topic, anything but Pater. She had never been in a conversation with quite so many landmines. Who's in colonial affairs now?
Oh, another Consuline lackey, Davor Raymond. Oh, it's dawned on them, well, on everyone, I guess, that repeatable rejuvenation could cause the biggest population explosion ever, as well as locking up wealth in the very, very old. Oh, that'd mean a lot of ambitious, frustrated young people. So, colonization has been speeding up for some time. Well, I didn't know that. Buttons told me he'd talk to Dad about it, but I found out that Consuline Sept has major investments in development companies, and their projections for the rate at which excess population can be absorbed by development make no sense, unless there's a much higher failure rate than before. That bit of information I got from a clerk in Colonial who'd been fired for insubordination. Oh, it all makes me suspicious.
Cecilia carefully erected bomb-proof partitions in her mind against a loose tongue.
You remember that Ronnie is my nephew?
Yes, of course.
His parents are concerned about the situation on the world he's moved to. I hear that some supplies in the contract weren't actually delivered, that there's the possibility of interference with communications. What if the Consulines are counting on a certain percentage of colonies to fail because they get their profit from selling colony shares?
Oh, I could believe that. But how could we prove it?
I don't know. We need Kevil. I'd better go visit him.
It's pretty bad. You know he lost an arm, too.
No, I didn't. When I saw him in the hospital before I took off with the babies, it was just a shape in the bed, and I didn't have much time.
They're trying to grow a replacement, but so far it hasn't worked. They've lost 3 buds. And George says his memory's still damaged and he can't concentrate.
Is he still in the hospital?
No. They moved him to a rehab center, and then George took him home. Our wonderful new speaker decided he was a security risk at the rehab center.
Well then, I'll go over tomorrow. Maybe I can be of some help.
You know, Uncle Harless runs the Planetary Development Corporations for the Barraclough Sept. What colony are Ronnie and Rafa in?
Except 24.
Rats. I was hoping it was one of ours. That way I could pump them. Exet Environmental Group is a Consuline corporation. I wonder why they chose that one instead of family. Oh, not that it matters.
I don't know. Possibly the shares cost less?
Could be. Anyway, I bet something's going on all these new colonies. I wish I had Kevil's background files, because I rather suspect the data in the main computers had been fiddled with as well. And now that I've talked your ears off, both of them, how about a visit to the stable? We don't have much here, as you probably remember, but there are a couple of nice mares we could take a ride through the orchards on, if you like.
No, thank you, my dear. Everyone thinks of me as a thoroughly horse-besotted old woman, but one prerogative of old women is to surprise young ones occasionally. I shall go stroll in your gardens, if I may.
Well, then, I'm for the pool. See you at dinner.